Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. On today's Your Call, we continue our week-long series on immigration by talking about how immigrants and communities are coping with immigration raids. According to the latest numbers from the Department of Homeland Security, immigration officers have arrested more than 680 people in at least a dozen states, including California, South Carolina, and Georgia. Immigrants say they are living in fear. One of today's guests, Juan Prieto, says he feels more silenced than ever, and yet he refuses to return to the shadows. Juan Prieto is an undocumented student, a senior at UC Berkeley studying English. He says his family came to the United States because of NAFTA. His family members worked in American manufacturing plants in Mexico, but they could not afford to live on low wages. And Juan Prieto joins us from Berkeley. Hi, Juan. Welcome to the show.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for having me.
Good morning. Great to have you. We're also joined by Ali, an immigrant from Yemen who's been in the United States since 2000. Ali says he's also living in fear, but he says he has to speak out. He is married to a green card holder and he has three kids. Hi, Ali. Welcome to the show.
Hey, good morning. Thanks, guys, for having me today.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. And we're joined by Jenny Zhao, a staff attorney in the Immigrant Rights Program at the Asian Americans Advancing Justice Asian Law Caucus. Jenny provides immigration legal services to low-income Asian Pacific Islander immigrants and works to challenge unjust detention and deportation policies. Hi, Jenny. Thank you for joining us.
Good morning, Rose. It's good to be here.
It's great to have you. So we have these numbers from the Department of Homeland Security. Over the past couple of days, more than 680 people have been arrested in at least a dozen states. Jenny, can you tell us how these raids are being conducted?
Well, there's been a lot of news and a lot of misinformation about the raids, including panic about ICE setting up checkpoints and things of that nature. So it's unclear what has been confirmed exactly, but we do know that ICE agents have been going to people's homes often in the early hours of the morning and basically detaining both people who they had originally targeted and also sometimes others who happened to be present in the home. We've also heard news of workplace raids.
Where can people go to find information? Because I think it's because of social media. So many people are rightly frightened, and a lot of misinformation is being shared. So what is the best way to find out what is actually happening?
Right. Well, I think there have been a number of local hotlines that have been activated where people are being encouraged to call to report raids. And there are people on the ground who will then go and try to verify those raids before spreading the news. So I can provide some of those hotlines if you'd like. There's one called the ICE Out of California hotline, and that number is 844-878-7801. And there's also a San Francisco-focused hotline, which is 415-200-1548.
All right, thank you. We'll also put those numbers on our website. Jenny, the other question is, this is nothing new. We've done a lot of shows about raid ICE crackdowns under Barack Obama. He was called the deporter-in-chief by many immigrant rights organizations. How are the raids that we're seeing now under Donald Trump different from what we saw under Barack Obama?
Right. I think that's a really good point, that these raids are in some ways nothing new. They're part of a massive deportation machinery that really ramped up under the Obama administration. So we know that we saw record numbers of raids and deportations under Obama. In addition to the home raids, there are hundreds of people who are funneled into deportation proceedings every day, largely through ICE contact with local jails. So in some ways, that's nothing new. I think the extra level of panic here is partly because of the so-called collaterals that we're hearing about, folks who were not necessarily the targets of the raids, but happened to be in the wrong place at the wrong time. But I think it's really important for us as community members and advocates to recognize that the raids are a crisis not just because other people, so-called collaterals, were swept up, but because we have hundreds of people who are very much embedded in their communities who are being ripped apart from their families. And that's true whether that person has a previous criminal conviction or has a previous removal order. So I think we really need to focus on the humanity of each person who was picked up in one of these raids.
And because there are so many executive orders coming down in such a fast amount of time, it's hard to keep up. Can you tell us specifically what the executive order does and says, the one that specifically targets immigrants in the United States?
Sure. So this was one of the earlier executive orders that was issued very quickly after Trump entered office. And it does a number of things in terms of interior enforcement, including hiring additional ICE agents and saying that sanctuary jurisdictions would lose federal funding. I think one piece of the order that has gotten the most attention is this change in enforcement priorities from Obama policy. So Obama had implemented this policy where people with certain types of criminal convictions would be prioritized for deportation. And it appears that this new memo has pretty much done away with any pretense of prioritization, because any person who has been convicted of an offense, has been even charged with an offense, or committed acts that could be an offense would be targets for deportation, as well as people who have deportation orders.
Can you elaborate on that a little bit? Because Donald Trump often says that he wants to get rid of, quote, criminals. And The Nation magazine had a really good story late last year about how under Barack Obama, people who came to the United States and then were deported and came back were now treated as a criminal. And so according to this story, the Obama administration set up a system that allows Donald Trump to deport these people because they're called, quote, criminals. So can you talk more about that? It's not getting that much attention.
Sure. Well, I think it's true that the rhetoric of various administrations has been incredibly consistent, actually. So every president claims that they're deporting the worst. They're going after felons, not families. That's just kind of the language that's used to basically justify these xenophobic deportation policies. But I think it's important for us to recognize that this definition of criminal versus non-criminal is really malleable. So yes, you can criminalize a person who reentered the United States after being deported. You can also criminalize a young person who maybe grew up in a rough neighborhood and joined a gang for protection. So I think this is, it's a label that's used to divide communities, and we don't want to legitimize this very flawed and racist criminal justice system that we have by saying that it's okay to go after immigrants because they're criminals.
And according to the Migration Policy Institute, if you look at undocumented immigrants who've been charged with violent crimes like manslaughter, assault, things like that, you're talking about 300,000 people.
Yeah, well, I think there are a lot of fuzzy numbers out there about, you know, undocumented immigrants, documented immigrants, and what types of crimes they've committed. But I think, you know, each of those people has, they have a past, they have a family, they have their own story for how they got to where they were. And in many cases, these are folks who made a mistake when they, you know, at some point in their lives and have rehabilitated. And I don't think it's fair to say that that person is completely disposable because of something that happened in their past. So I think as advocates, we need to be really careful about these divide and conquer tactics. Mm.
We're doing this show today to focus on personal stories. And I want to ask you about the woman who's getting a lot of attention, Guadalupe Garcia de Reyes. She was deported on Wednesday. She was detained on Wednesday and deported within 24 hours to her native Mexico. And she lives in Arizona. She has been going to the immigration department on a regular basis since she was arrested in 2008 and convicted for using a fake social security number. She's visited the immigration office 8 times, and she's married. She's got 2 children, and she never had a problem until this time, this last Wednesday when she went to check in. She was detained and then deported. Can you talk a little bit about that, and why did that happen?
Sure. So it's a really terrifying story for a lot of our clients. So there are thousands of people, if not more, around the country who are in a similar situation where maybe they have a deportation order, or maybe they had a pending case in immigration court, but for whatever reason there's been an agreement not to pursue their deportation. And they're sort of in this limbo where they don't have status in the U.S., but they are living here, they're contributing to their communities, they're taking care of their families, and now they have to live under this terror that at any point if they go in for a routine check-in with ICE, they could be detained. So as lawyers, it's really hard to advise our clients on what to do in this situation because they may have had an expectation that they will be able to continue making this their home, and now that is just feeling less secure for folks.
And she came to the United States in the mid-90s with her parents when she was 14, and she's now 35 and just deported. Do we have any idea what's going to happen to her?
Well, I think, you know, she's clearly being returned to a country that she hasn't been to in decades, and I can only imagine how difficult it is to be separated from her family and what's happening to her kids here in the U.S. And it's just, unfortunately, it's just one example out of so many of ICE taking people away from their communities.
Before we let you go, Jenny, do you have any other stories that you'd like to share?
Well, I think, you know, in terms of our clients, we've just been hearing both a lot of fear from people, but also a lot of resilience. We do have the majority of our clients are facing deportation proceedings. And so in some ways, they're already in the system, and they've already been fighting immigration enforcement for years. So it's been actually really heartening to hear from people that they're afraid, but they know that they're going to continue to fight their cases. And under whatever administration, they're going to continue asserting their rights and do everything they can to stay here with their families.
Jenny Zhao is a staff attorney in the Immigrant Rights Program at the Asian Americans Advancing Justice Asian Law Caucus. Jenny, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
We wanted to get an update on what's happening around the executive orders. A number of lawsuits have been filed, and so we wanted to bring Jenny on to give us an update. And today we're continuing our week-long series on immigration by talking about how immigrants and communities are coping with the executive orders, the fear, and the raids. And if you have a story you'd like to share, we want to open the lines today to get your views on what's happening right now, to get your personal stories. What has changed in your community? If you know, in the Bay Area, so many people have stories. If you've got an immigration story you'd like to share, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today we're joined by Ali, an immigrant from Yemen who's been in the U.S. since 2000. He says that he has to speak out. He's married to a green card holder and has three children. Juan Prieto is an undocumented senior at UC Berkeley studying English. He says that he feels more silenced than ever, and yet he refuses to return to the shadows. His family came to the U.S. because of NAFTA. The only jobs that were available were in American manufacturing plants, and his family could not afford to live on those low wages. And Juan, before you tell your story, I just want to get your reaction to this 35-year-old woman, Guadalupe Garcia de Reyes, who has lived in the United States since she was 14. And on a regular immigration checkup just last week, she was detained on Wednesday and then deported within 24 hours to her native Mexico.
Yeah, I think, as Jenny was saying, the sort of like the how malleable these criminal laws are and how careful we need to be when we move forward as a community, because I feel like as a student for the last couple of years, we've sort of riled up behind that sort of dream narrative that sort of protected a lot of the students is now sort of showing itself to be nothing more than flawed because of the reality of criminal law and how oftentimes it's racialized. And immigration law is, I think, one of the most malleable laws that, you know, we can live under. It's constantly changing, and depending on an administration can sort of change the attitude of the people enforcing these laws. Mm-hmm. And so that's what we see with Guadalupe. We see someone who, you know, maybe even began to trust that she'd be fine because she had been going to these regular checkups, just how we felt like we were going to be fine because we had applied for DACA or followed the law, whatever that might mean. And now you have a case where following these laws or following these checkups don't really matter anymore. And so that sort of causes a lot of anxiety in us that if we played your game for so long, and we were fine, but now we're not. What's it going to look like for the rest of the people in this community?
Juan, you say that you feel more silenced than ever, and yet you're really speaking out. You wrote an op-ed in the New York Times called "Even at Berkeley, I Face Threats as an Undocumented Student." You did a perspective on KQED called "Undocumented and Unafraid." Why are you deciding to speak out so forcefully?
Yeah, no, actually, that's something I get asked a lot, because there's the fear and anxiety that comes with being so outspoken about this, of constantly having to look over my shoulder when I'm walking around campus, because, you know, to be far right is no longer something that doesn't happen at Berkeley. It's actually very common. Mm. So, you know, a part of me was extremely afraid and didn't want to continue being outspoken. I was very outspoken under the Obama administration in my community. And so when this happened, I thought either I fall back in the shadows or I rise up in anger and face whatever consequences might come. A lot of the resources that I was granted did not come from people being afraid, even if there was no sort of safety net to fall back under. It came from people rising up to that fear and speaking out and constantly providing that perspective of, you know, you have people utilizing data to speak about immigration. You have people talking about taxes being paid, how many people are going to school, how many people are committing crimes, or, all, you know, you have all these statistics, but it removes a lot of the humanity from it. And so I thought I should speak out, and a lot of my friends feel like we should speak out to provide that human reality, because, you know, we either get painted as a perfectly good immigrant or a terribly bad one. There's nothing in between. There's no room for flaws. You know, there's not room for a student who is good at school to then get a DUI because of a mistake they committed. And so I think speaking out and creating that bridge of we're not good or bad, we're somewhere in the middle, can provide the insight to move the conversation beyond where it's led us so far.
Ali, you are an immigrant from Yemen. You've been living in the United States since 2000. You say you're also living in fear, but you think it's really important to speak out. Can you tell us about why you've decided to speak out and speak out on this show today?
Well, like you say, we all afraid now worse than before. Our friend, the one who was talking, we was under the shadow. We don't want to show ourselves, but now we go into the regular meeting with the immigration because I'm in TBS from Yemen. We cannot go back to Yemen because the war is going on over there. But we afraid to go back to the immigration just for a regular fingerprint. And who knows, it might happen to us and they deport us just like everybody else. And we haven't done nothing wrong. We pay in taxes. Got three kids in here and they're American citizens, and if they deport us, who's gonna take care of my kids? So should I stay hiding or should I go to my regular appointment? No, I should go to my regular appointment, but I'm gonna be safe. So we need to speak up so people don't be afraid of what's going on, and all the community need to come together. It's not about Muslim or Yemenis people or Arabian people. It's about the Latino community, the Arabian, Muslim. Everybody's supposed to come together so we can fight this madness. I mean, how come the president, he said he's speaking of all the American people mind. He's the president of all, he presenting all the American people. Is he presenting my kid, my American kid, the kid they born there, when he gonna deport their dad and leave them here by themselves, nobody take care of them? I don't think so. He's speaking of them.
And I understand, Ali, you are on temporary protected status right now.
Yes.
What is that?
As status from the immigration, they give it to the people, the country they in war. It's just like the people can go back to their country because there's a big war over there. It's just like refugees. So we can even go back to Yemen. It's not even airport to fly us to there. So what are they going to do with us, even if they hold us in the jail? They're going to keep us in jail forever till the war is over in Yemen? So what's going to happen to us?
That's another question. I mean, it needs to be answered from somebody.
Hmm. Yeah, and last week we just did a show about what is happening in Yemen. Under Obama, the United States was backing the Saudi attack on Yemen, and then that botched raid happened under Trump recently. Let's go to a couple callers who also want to share their immigration stories. And if you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback at yourcallradio.org. Let's hear from Lisa in San Francisco. Hi, Lisa.
Hi, yes. I'm the daughter of an immigrant woman who arrived here in 1955. However, she was always very good at connecting the dots and struggling for people who for the undocumented here. One of the things that people fail to realize is the effect of the economic policies such as the North American Free Trade Agreement. It decimated the peasant population, the peasant farming population there. So, of course, you're going to have people looking for work in other places, especially in the United States. Also, the issue of our support, the United States support for the Mexican, for the drug, so-called drug war, where they send weapons and money to Mexico. However, those weapons end up in the hands of the cartel. And there's incredible violence happening in Mexico, against people. And especially also if people come from the United States, they assume that they have money saved and things like that. So there's kidnapping of people going on by these drug cartels. So the fear that these people feel is legitimate. And that would qualify them as refugees, not just, just regular immigrants. It was the situation that we have a responsibility towards them, because we have been the ones in this country destroying their economies and their life by the actions of our government.
Well, it's a great point, and unfortunately the dots are not always connected. Those dots are connected in an excellent documentary called Harvest of Empire, and it looks at U.S. foreign policy in Central and South America, and so many people are interviewed about why they come to this country, and most of them say, we really didn't want to come, but we had no choice because of violence, poverty, what have you. And Juan, you have personal experience with this. Your family decided to come to the United States because of NAFTA. Can you tell us more about that?
Yeah, so there was a Tommy Hilfiger factory right around the corner from my neighborhood.
Did you say Tommy Hilfiger?
Tommy Hilfiger, and it was the only sort of stable income that could come to that community, and that was a result of NAFTA. Unfortunately, it was only 100 pesos a day, which is no less than a dollar. And so we were expected to survive off of that. I remember my uncles were working for it, and I mean, everyone in the neighborhood was working for it. If you walked around our Jewish neighborhood, you would see a lot of people wearing that clothing, but that was only because they would take the fact. And so the alternative route was joining a gang and dealing drugs, and so that wasn't really what happened. And then
Juan, we're having a hard time hearing you. Maybe you can go to a different part of your room.
Sorry about that.
Okay, that's better.
Yeah, and so there was that sort of the only source of income for the community was that factory or dealing drugs, and so that just became the reality I was surrounded with. And then when the war on drugs began to be waged on border towns, which is where I was born, that violence began to spread across my neighborhood, and it just became obvious that we needed to flee. And so, again, my mom and dad would have preferred to have stayed. It's where we had been raised our whole lives. And so we packed everything and came to a country we didn't know, to a language we did not understand, uncertain whether we'd be accepted, and realized that that was better than the alternative, which was the violence in Mexico.
And how much, again, were your family members making at the Tommy Hilfiger plant?
Yeah, it continues to be very low, but it was 100 pesos a day, which is less than a dollar.
A dollar a day.
Yeah, and expected to survive off of that.
I mean, and many parts of Mexico are not cheap. What are the wages today at the same factory?
I'm not 100% sure, but I know it's still very low. A lot of people from border towns try to get visas to work in the United States and then move back and then send money back, but... Yeah, it's it's still unlivable for certain.
And Juan, before we go to break, I read a lot of the comments under your stories at your perspective at KQED, your editorial at the New York Times, and I mean, a lot of these comments are just downright racist. Do you feel like, do people ask you, why did your family come here? Do they get the connection to NAFTA? I mean, you have basically said, if the United States hadn't come to our country, we wouldn't have had to leave it.
Yeah, no, I get that question a lot, actually, of why don't you just go back? And I'm like, you know what? I if my country were in a better position, it probably become the best alternative. You know, we're the sort of students, like I said earlier, that we're supposed to be the most sort of championed for, and we're still facing this very racist vitriol from the right. And so what's the rest of the community facing, if that's the case? And so, yeah, it's, I guess people don't often connect the dots of, you know, if you impose yourself on other countries, the result's going to be people fleeing it and coming to the United States. It was the same for my dad, who fled El Salvador after the United States started to fund the very strong militant government at the time. And so the rebellion rose up higher, and there was more violence, there were more deaths, and so my dad and his family had to flee El Salvador. And so that's just sort of my reality with immigration, that we only fled countries that were torn because the United States imposed itself on it. And now we're out here and they're trying to blame us for all its woes, when in reality, the woes of our countries come directly from the United States infiltrating.
When did your family leave Mexico, Juan?
We left in early 2001, January 2001 is when we left, yeah.
That is Juan Prieto. He is an undocumented senior at UC Berkeley studying English. He hopes to go to law school. As you heard, he says his family came to the United States in 2001 because of NAFTA. They could not pay the bills, earning less than a dollar a day, working at a Tommy Hilfiger manufacturing plant. We're also joined today by Ali. He's an immigrant from Yemen who's been in the U.S. since 2000. He's living in fear, but says he has to speak out. Ali is married to a green card holder and has three kids. And today we're continuing our week-long series on immigration by talking about personal stories. How are immigrants and communities coping with the executive orders and the immigration raids? And we'd love to hear from you. If you have a personal story, we hope you call in and share it with us. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this.
There are many ways you can take part in the conversation today on Your Call. You can call us on the telephone. You can send us an email to feedback@yourcallradio. You can go to our website, which is yourcallradio.org. You can also tweet us @yourcallradio. If you'd like to participate in today's show, our telephone number toll free is 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we'll continue our week-long series on immigration by talking about what a fair and humane immigration policy would actually look like. We're hearing so many stories about people who are living in fear over the consequences of being detained, jailed, and deported. And then we've got the refugee crisis. So what would a humane and just immigration system look like? And then on Thursday, we will talk about how you can get involved, participate, and plug in to various immigration communities. Lots of teach-ins are happening around the country, and so we'll be talking about that on Thursday. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, we are talking about personal stories and really putting a human face on the politics and on the numbers that we hear on a regular basis. And if you have a story to share, we'd love to hear from you. Or if you have questions for our guests, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, we're joined by Ali, an immigrant from Yemen who's been in the U.S. since 2000. He's married to a green card holder and has three children. Juan Prieto is an undocumented senior at UC Berkeley studying English. He says his family came to the U.S. in 2001 because of NAFTA. They just could not make it on the dollar a day that they were making in a Tommy Hilfiger plant. And you can join us, 866-798-8255. And thank you for calling in, Lisa. Let's go next to Barnaby in California. Hi, Barnaby. Welcome to the show.
Hi. So I'm a legal green card holder. I immigrated here as a child. And the only thing I have a problem with what the discussion now on immigration is the moral turpitude clause, which in other words is if I break a law of sex, violence, or drugs, as a legal green card holder and get convicted of it, I get deported. Under the sanctuary city statutes, a lot of people who are illegal immigrants could break the same law, be convicted, and then not be deported under the protection from ICE. And I'm all for immigration reform. I'm all for due process to get make sure that people are not wrongfully deported. But when I'm compliant with the law, as a green card holder, having lived and traveled back and forth, held at borders, questioned repeatedly, nearly denied entrance over stuff, and then have to go process and get another lawyer after being here for a long time, someone who does get a DUI, as we referred to by one of the callers earlier, if they were a green card holder, that's a deportable offense. Under the statutes that are legal immigrants, to not deport someone who breaks the same law that's an illegal immigrant is absolutely hypocritical to ask of people who try to comply and obey the laws correctly.
Well, we don't have a lawyer on the show to comment, but Juan, are you familiar with sanctuary cities and the legalities around them?
I know the basic of the police will not cooperate with ICE officials. Or hold them, and it depends from city to city what that sanctuary law looks like.
Right, because I heard this morning that New York City is a sanctuary city, but people have been deported over the last couple of days there.
Same with Los Angeles, yeah.
Right.
It doesn't mean that the city itself will protect people from deportation. It just means that city officials will not cooperate with ICE. I think additionally to the comment on the DUI that I had made, I think if we continue to set these, you know, unfathomable standards for ourselves of perfection when beyond everything we're flawed humans just trying to survive and commit mistakes every so often, I don't think it should be a case of, well, this is done to me, why shouldn't it be done to you? It should be a case of, why is it done to anyone? Why should a family member be torn from their family, removed from the community that they've learned to understand and have cooperated in just because of a mistake they committed one night? I think would be my response to that. But it shouldn't be a, why, if it's happening to me, it should happen to you. It should be a, why is it happening at all? Why are families being split over something as simple as, I drove under the influence?
Well, you know, it's a good question, and it's something that we really need to talk about. And we, you know, I will talk about this on tomorrow's show, Barnaby. Maybe we can find a lawyer who can answer these questions. Tomorrow we're going to talk about what a just and humane immigration policy should look like. What should a progressive immigration policy look like? I mean, this is a conversation we really need to have. And so I will jot this down, and I'll bring up your question, and we'll have more information about sanctuary cities tomorrow. So thank you for calling in. Let's go next to John in San Francisco. Hi, John. Welcome to the show. Do we have John? Well, along those same lines, John, he had a question. Juan, John had a question for you. Under what circumstances do you believe people should be deported?
You know, I think that's often sort of used to sort of throw people under the bus. That's why it's sort of, it's become like, oh, we're only deporting criminals. But then that becomes very obscure and that law becomes very malleable. And so when it comes to criminal law, we've sort of understood it now as in terms of mass incarceration and the sort of racial aspect of these criminal laws, separate from immigration. But when you tie it together, immigration becomes more complicated. here you have a group of people who are not allowed to sort of join the larger social class and have no form of social mobility, and it just becomes obvious that sort of doing whatever is necessary for survival, whether that be dealing with drugs or possessing drugs, it just becomes more of an option if you're sort of put off in the fringes of society. So, you know, and if we allow this narrative of like, well, let's get rid of the criminals, does that then not open up the space for these petty crimes to become a reason for deportation, as we're seeing is the case? They attempt to sort of justify the deportation of humans and the separation of families based on past crimes, but then these crimes become as small as driving without a license, which is what undocumented immigrants have been doing in California before AB 60 was passed.
Right.
So I would just be very careful about weighing sort of crime into this, and being very careful about how we deal with, you know, these are people with families, people with community ties that we're talking about.
Well, we'll definitely talk more about these issues tomorrow, because we are going to have a lawyer on the show to talk about what a just and humane immigration policy would look like. So if you have any other questions about who should be detained, who should be deported, those questions I think would be best to bring up on tomorrow's show. And thank you again for calling. And sorry we didn't take your call, but we did take your question. Juan Prieto is an undocumented senior at UC Berkeley and says his family came to the U.S. in 2001 because of NAFTA. And like so many Mexicans who worked in American manufacturing plants, they could not afford to take care of their families on less than a dollar a day. We're also joined by Ali, an immigrant in Yemen, or from Yemen, who's been in the U.S. since 2000. And he says that he just has to speak out at this time. He's married to a green card holder and has three children. Ali, at this point, what worries you the most? We're hearing that these ICE raids are going to continue.
Yes. Well, like I said, what I'm worried about, I was hiding for so many years till I got help from Iraq as a nonprofit organization, and helped me to get the TBS, and I got, you know, sort of paper, and I'm kind of legal, but I'm in, you know, I can't get deported under the new law. But after when I come to life, I'm paying taxes now, and I'm working. I have benefits with my kids. My kids, they always been in, like, what they call it, medical, but now we have benefits, and I have a job, and I'm start living. I just start, you know, for one first time I'm paying taxes and I'm start living my life. And soon when I get that one, now the stuff feels like it's gonna go away again. So I'm gonna go back hiding again. I don't know. And like I said, there's a lot of people just like me, from hundreds of people, Yemenese people, or like Eritrean, Somalian, from the banned countries, and from a lot of other countries, you know, affected by this new executive orders. So, like I said, we all afraid of this new, all this new executive orders. We don't know what to do. Even my son, 6 years old, he asked me, "What's gonna happen if they send you away?" I said, "Nobody's gonna send me away." He said, "No, we hear about they're gonna send you away." And he's 6 years old. He didn't even know what mean, you know, leaving his dad, or, you know, being by himself in this life.
Yeah, we're hearing that from so many children asking their parents these questions. Ali, what are you hearing from other friends in your community, people from, say, Yemen and some of the other seven predominantly Muslim countries that were included in that last executive order?
Well, a lot of people, they prayed. A lot of people, they went back hiding. Like, they didn't even file for taxes. You know, they wasn't TBS, but they said, "Oh, no, we might go now and, you know, file for taxes and, you know, showing ourselves, but they're going to come and take us." So they went back to hide again. And some people, like I did, I just went and filed for taxes, and they know where I'm at. So if they just want to take me, they can, you know, come. They know where I live and where I stay, where I work. So, because, like I said, I'm kind of, you know, kind of legal status, but who knows if they can, you know, they can say, yeah, you wasn't deportation before, but now you're on TBS, so they might deport me, but I don't know.
And Ellie, have you faced any discrimination since all of this started festering?
Well, not really, but I heard a lot of stuff in the news on the Facebook about all this, you know, people discriminating Muslim people and, you know, pulling woman hijab and all that stuff. The same stuff everybody saw in the media and Facebook, Twitter, and all that stuff. But to me, I haven't experienced any of that stuff.
And we heard from Juan about why his family came to the United States in 2001 because of NAFTA. Ali, you've been here since 2000. Why did you leave Yemen?
Well, I was running away. It's like a revenge thing in Yemen. One of my family killed somebody, and they want to kill me, so I ran away from Yemen so I won't get killed because somebody else killed somebody. And when I got here, I had a sad story. I got a bad heart, so I have to have a surgery. So I stayed with 2 years with a medical condition here because my heart, I need to get a heart surgery, and I got it, and I got it fixed. And I'm still got that bad heart and bad medical condition. But thank God I was in the United States, and I got help, and I got all this fixed for through this 17 years. But now, my God, what if I go back home to Yemen, I cannot even get that kind of medical attention, too.
That is Ali, an immigrant from Yemen who's been here since 2000. He is living in fear, but says it's very important to speak out. He's married to a green card holder and has 3 children. And Juan Prieto is an undocumented senior at UC Berkeley studying English. He hopes to go to law school. His family came to the U.S. in 2001 because of NAFTA, and they couldn't make it on the less than dollar a day they were making working in an American manufacturing plant. And today we are continuing our week-long series on immigration by talking about personal stories. And if you have a personal story, a family story you'd like to share, we'd love to hear from you. And what's going through your mind as you're hearing people talk about living in fear? The one story that I cannot get out of my mind is about a refugees from Somalia and Ghana who are leaving the United States and going to Canada. Because it's so cold, they're losing their fingers. I mean, this is just so difficult to believe that this is happening in 2017. But they're leaving the U.S. because they're so afraid. They're going into Canada where it's freezing and they don't have the proper clothing. And so they're losing their fingers to frostbite. So if there's any stories that you've been hearing in the news and you'd like to talk about, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Now, it's great to hear that Ali has not faced discrimination, but Juan, you have. In the New York Times op-ed you wrote, you write about helping organize an action at UC Berkeley last year to get the UC system to renew funding for programs for undocumented students. And you wrote that you were called an illegal leech who should be deported. And then a few months later, you received an anonymous email threatening to report your family to immigration agents. And you write that you were so disturbed, you stopped attending your classes.
Yeah, it was kind of a really intense point in my life because I had grown so accustomed to being outspoken about my status and bringing that very critical lens into the conversation of, you know, speaking of why I left and what the United States' role was in that process. And so I had become very comfortable with sharing that story. And when we organized this action, when our resources were about to lose a lot of their funding necessary for our survival here, it sort of made me realize that in being so outspoken, I can also become a target. And so that was the first time I sort of connected that to the reality of it, that, you know, regardless of how I feel, whether I feel like this place is where, you know, I was raised and so this is where I belong, that's not how the rest of the country feels. And not only that, but they even have the power to report me, and Right now, I don't even know where immigration law is going. I have been arrested before, but that was taking an act of civil disobedience. So I don't know if to protest. So I don't know if that itself all of a sudden becomes a crime worthy of deportation, even though I was just practicing my freedom of speech. So there's that fear too, that if I am too outspoken, if I become too critical of the country as I am taught to be at this university, then I've become a target. And so, you know, that's sort of the questions I've been asking myself in the last couple of days as this sort of conversation on freedom of speech becomes a national debate after what happened on February 4th when Milo came to our campus and it was canceled. I wonder, well, what happens to my freedom of speech if I'm afraid to speak out because people might report me to immigration officials? I decided that, you know, silence is not going to solve my problem. Silence is maybe even going to make them worse. If we just decide to be silent and go back into the shadows, then what becomes of our community? And so, you know, I'm willing to sort of continue to receive the threats and see where that takes me, so long as I don't stop speaking my truth and letting people know that there's a human aspect to these immigration numbers that they keep seeing on the media.
You also write that you returned to class about a week later and your anxiety kept you from engaging in discussions or focusing on your studies. And you also criticize the university for being silent about the feeling of the students and being threatened with phone calls. And then we'll talk about Milo in just a couple minutes. But can you also talk about just your experience in reaching out to professors at UC Berkeley, or what do you think the school should do to deal with what's happening on campus?
Yeah, unfortunately, professors were extremely understanding. I attempted to go to class, and I'm usually someone who enjoys having conversations with other students, but I was relatively quiet, and I felt really disengaged. I was just uncertain whether that's where I needed to be at that time, and so I emailed my professors and told them I couldn't really sit in the class anymore. And they allowed me a couple of days to sort of recenter myself. Administration has been less responsive. You know, anytime we have conversations with them, they constantly throw, well, my hands are tied, which worried us a lot because, you know, as it claims to protect us, if it's already backing down in its protection of us, what will happen if the federal government decides to come after its students, if it decides to deport the undocumented or register our Muslim siblings? Like, what becomes of this my hands are tied conversation if Nicholas Dirks and the administration at UC Berkeley isn't already standing up for us and being outspoken and defending us? So that was the sort of fear and anxiety that it was causing at the time, that, you know, if they're not arising us for us, then what makes us think they will when it becomes harder, which is when we're going to need them the most.
Right. And as you said, this is happening on the campus at UC Berkeley. I mean, what's happening in places like, I don't know, Arizona, Texas, you name it. Because we focus so much on the politics and the numbers, can you talk just about words? Words have consequences. I mean, when Donald Trump kicked off his campaign, he went after Mexicans first by saying Mexicans are rapists. And now we have this. So how are you and your friends dealing with this? And how is it affecting your overall, I mean, how are you dealing with depression, marginalization? How is this affecting you?
Yeah, I recently had a conversation with friends about the anxiety and just overall depression of, you know, having your life mandated by the government. You know, you have your entire life at the disposal of an opinion, and that the sort of, you lose a lot of your agency, you lose a lot of your ability to think beyond tomorrow. Like, what am I going to do? What am I going to plan? You know, I had all these previous plans that are no longer as solid as I wanted them to be. And so, you know, the loss of that agency comes directly from the fact that my life can be completely changed depending on the opinion of a person elected into office. And, you know, to keep hearing this vitriol, this hatred about my community, when I know my community best, I am surrounded by my community, and I know the reality of it, the human, the fear, the fears, the love, the interest, the passions, like that reality does not match with the rhetoric of the Trump administration and his following. So that just sort of, if it's frustration after frustration to constantly hear and have people assume things of you that you know are not true.
Hmm. What would you add, Ali? How does the rhetoric, how does it affect you?
Well, one last thing I want to say before I get back to work, because I'm just at my lunchtime.
Oh, okay.
Is the main thing now is everybody got to get together. I'm talking about all community, Muslim, Jewish, Christian, Hispanic, African, like you said, Somalian, Arterian, Muslim people, Arabian people, they need to get together. And I saw it with my own eyes working. Like when we was in the airport, when they first shut the people coming with a green card, we shut down the airport in San Francisco. We stand up together. And when I first saw, I never believed it. Like Muslim people standing in the San Francisco airport and they're praying. And they stand next to the Jewish, next to the Christian. We all American. We all live in this country. We all love this country. And work, and we got people through from the airport. People was hold up for so many hours, and they don't let them in. But we did it, and we got them in. All I'm saying, we have to stand up all together on this hard time till we get through.
Well, Ali, thank you for joining us during your lunch break. We really appreciate you sharing your stories.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Ali is an immigrant from Yemen who's been in the U.S. since 2000. He is living in fear, he says, but he wants to speak out. He's married to a green card holder and he has three kids. And Juan Prieto is an undocumented senior at UC Berkeley studying English. He says his family came to the U.S. in 2001 because of NAFTA and they could not make ends meet, working for less than a dollar a day, working at a Tommy Hilfiger manufacturing plant. And I hope you can check out Juan's articles at yourcallradio.org. Juan, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for providing the microphone.
Thank you. And coming up on tomorrow's show, we'll continue our week-long series on immigration by talking about what a fair and humane immigration policy would look like. As we've been hearing, immigrants and communities are struggling with fear over the consequences of being detained, jailed, and deported. So what would a humane system look like? That is tomorrow. And then next Tuesday, The Roxy is hosting a screening of Merchants of Doubt. That's the documentary about how climate deniers sell doubt about climate change. And following the film, I'll be on a panel about climate change reporting. The film starts at 7 o'clock, and you can find more information at Roxy, roxie.com. Your Call is produced here at KALW. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan produced today's show. Helena Murphy is assistant producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. Kevin Vance is our studio engineer. You can email us feedback@yourcallradio.org. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. Thanks for joining us.